Sandy. She says her goal is to reduce food waste and thus lower the amount of land disturbed to grow crops while helping farmers sell their full harvest. Keller says Climate Candy is about making a lower carbon footprint, sustainable packaging, and upcycled ingredients.
If we can just help people realize their power in our highest potential solution to heal ourselves and the planet is just what we choose to eat, and that includes all of us, that's really been our secret to success.
The candy is made from a puree of vegetables like carrots and beets and flavored with many different fruits, including cherry, apple, blueberry, raspberry, lemon, orange, and strawberry. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Now let's check out this week's point puzzle.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked what the following cities have in common: Mobile, Alabama, Nashua, New Hampshire, Charlotte, North Carolina, and Eugene, Oregon. Well, the answer is that all of the consonants in each city are contained in the name of its home state. Our winner this week is Levy, who listens to KPOV in Bend, Oregon.
Listen now to words that begin with letter C.
Crazy character, constantly creating concoctions. Catalyst like cannibalistic rhymes. Conqueror, correctly connecting. Craniums crumble down. Consistent capacity.
For the new puzzle, take a commonly defined set of seven things that is relevant to this month. Remove all letters that are not unique, and what you have left are the letters from the words wavy tub. So again, start with a commonly defined set of seven things. Remove all the letters that are not unique, and what you have left are the words wavy tub. When you have an answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday. This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of June 17th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 20th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Suzanne Potter, and Mike Moen. The producers Annette Newell and our engineers Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell, so glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. So if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Ukraine's security, tested by Russia, strengthened by the U.S. The U.S. may expand its nuclear weapons inventory. And China's trade relations, mostly bad news for Beijing. First, Ukraine security. On June 13, Vladimir Putin offered a peace proposal that he knew would be rejected out of hand by Ukraine, the United States, and the European Union. The proposal calls for Russia to take over four regions of Ukraine, even though Russian forces do not occupy all of them, for the West to remove all sanctions on Russia, and for Ukraine to become a neutral country unable to join NATO. In return, Russia offers a ceasefire and negotiations to end the war. Not coincidentally, this proposal coincided with the start of a peace conference in Switzerland that Russia was not invited to attend. Apparently, as an alternative to Ukraine's membership in NATO, President Biden and Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky plan to sign a 10-year security agreement. The main content is ongoing U.S. military aid to Ukraine, supporting defense and deterrence capability, said Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, and not a promise of U.S. forces. Since this will be an executive agreement and not a treaty, the agreement does not require a Senate consent, nor does it bind future U.S. administrations, meaning that Trump could end the agreement if he becomes president. Further bolstering Ukraine's cause is agreement by the G7 group to lend Ukraine $500 billion taken from frozen Russian assets. The G7 includes Britain, Germany, France, Italy, Canada, the United States, Japan, plus the European Union. The United States has been pressing the Europeans to make this move, and now the deal is done. Expect outrage from the Kremlin. The U.S., by the way, has also pledged another $1.5 billion for Ukraine from the Agency for International Development budget to provide energy assistance, repair damaged energy infrastructure, help refugees, and strengthen civilian security. In Switzerland, 90 countries concluded a Ukraine peace conference without Russia, which, again, wasn't invited, and without China, which withdrew. The overwhelming majority of the countries present said the UN Charter and, quote, respect for territorial integrity and sovereignty can and will serve as a basis for achieving a comprehensive, just, and lasting peace in Ukraine. That position is a decisive rejection of Putin's proposal that peace talks begin with Ukraine agreeing to Russia's occupation of about 20% of its territory. However, a number of Global South countries did not sign the final document, including India, Brazil, and South Africa. The United States may expand its nuclear weapons inventory. A senior U.S. official has said that the nuclear weapons arsenal may need to be expanded to deal with China's increasing arsenal and Russia's threat to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. According to the Pentagon, by 2035, China may match the number of U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons. And Putin has talked about putting a nuclear weapon in space, in violation of a treaty banning such a move. The U.S. warning may also reflect the erosion of arms control restraints. The last major nuclear arms agreement, called New START, S-T-A-R-T, with Russia, expires in February 2026, with no indication Russia will be interested in renewing it. That treaty limits each country to 1,550 deployed strategic nuclear weapons. Should the current or future U.S. administration expand the nuclear weapon arsenal, it would be yet another signal that Cold War II is on. Not that the U.S. nuclear arsenal has been unchanged in recent years. Billions of dollars have gone into periodic so-called modernization of the arsenal, making it even more powerful, accurate, and deliverable, though without adding to the numbers. China's response, delivered through the Russian state news agency, TASS, said, quote, the U.S. needs to reflect on its behavior and commit itself to doing the right thing. The U.S. should reduce the role of nuclear weapons in national and collective security policies and act responsibly for the welfare of the world. The U.S. sits on the largest and most advanced nuclear arsenal in the world. Even so, it clings to a first-use nuclear policy, devises nuclear deterrence strategies against others, and has invested heavily in upgrading its nuclear triad, referring to land, air, and sea-based missiles. All these charges are true, but China's response left out the fact that China has long refused to engage in nuclear arms reduction talks and is significantly expanding its strategic nuclear arsenal. Thus, we are in danger of repeating the nuclear arms race that dominated the 1960s to 1980s. That era was marked by dramatic overkill capacity in nuclear weapons, expansion of the delivery systems for nuclear weapons, and huge expenditures by all sides on weapons research, development, and deployment. There were also quite a number of so-called broken arrows, nuclear accidents that went unreported for years. Deployment of the weapons, especially by the U.S., made targets of allies in Europe and Asia. Now, just when it seemed that the nuclear danger had somewhat moderated, the threat of a nuclear-level conflict has become real again. A U.S.-China confrontation over Taiwan or in the South China Sea, use of a nuclear weapon by North Korea, deployment of Russian nukes to Belarus, a Russian nuclear attack in response to Ukraine's actions, any of these could spark a nuclear exchange, either intentional or accidental. China's trade relations, mostly bad news for Beijing. The G7 group concluded its summit in Italy with some fairly harsh statements about China. One of them focused on China's military support of Russia, saying, quote, "We will continue taking measures against actors in China and third countries that materially support Russia's war machine, including financial institutions, consistent with our legal systems and other entities in China that facilitate Russia's acquisition of items for its defense industrial base," unquote. In the G7's final communique, China was also hit for its, quote, "malicious cyber activity," and for trade practices such as dumping electric vehicles at below market prices. Listeners will recall my reports on the growing anxiety in the European Union over all these matters, which have seriously complicated EU-China relations. Now those relations are bound to get worse. The European Commission's decision to impose a 38% tariff on Chinese EVs, a move it had been signaling for some time, drew a strong reaction from China's Commerce Ministry. A spokesperson said the European Commission has ignored the fact that the Chinese EV industry's advantages stem from openness and competition. The European Commission also disregarded World Trade Organization rules, said the statement, and failed to acknowledge the full cooperation of relevant Chinese enterprises during the investigation. The spokesperson accused the European Commission of engaging in blatant protectionism that will escalate trade frictions. Another Chinese official complained that China was being singled out. Quote, "China has abundant corresponding countermeasures, but the country is more willing to negotiate with the European Union to avoid a trade war as much as possible. The European Commission's motive is not for trade development at all," says the statement. For example, Tesla has been temporarily excluded from the temporary tariff, which reflected how targeted the tariff is at China's electric vehicle industry. Meantime, in the United States, the State Department announced, quote, "sanctions on more than 100 individuals and entities, including seven based in China, for their support of the Russian war effort in Ukraine." The U.S. has been concerned for some time about China's assistance to Russia's military industries. At a news conference in Prague on May 31st, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said 70% of the machine tools that Russia is importing are coming from China, as well as 90% of microelectronics. New U.S. sanctions aim not just at suppliers of those items, but also at the banks that are believed to be financing sales. Blinken said, quote, "China cannot expect, on the one hand, to improve relations with countries of Europe, while on the other hand, fueling the biggest threat to European security since the end of the Cold War," unquote. The Biden administration hopes to persuade its European and Asian allies to follow suit on those sanctions. Thus far, however, sanctions have not dissuaded China, not to mention North Korea or Iran, from doing business with Russia. On the other hand, some good news for China on the trade front. Its premier, Li Qiang, concluded a successful trade mission to New Zealand, whose primary trade partner is China. New Zealand Prime Minister Christopher Lux noted that there were plenty of policy differences between the two countries, but said, quote, "the ability to be able to talk very directly and very upfront about issues that we might disagree on, have differences of opinions around, is actually a very good thing. It might be uncomfortable at times for both parties, but at least we're actually able to do that," unquote. Some New Zealanders think the government has been too soft on China, especially with regard to human rights and Chinese pressure tactics on trade. But the government counters that New Zealand is too close to China and too trade dependent to stake out a hostile position like the U.S. Premier Li next travels to Australia. where he faces a less accommodating government that has had its own battles with China over trade versus human rights and political interference. In other news, Hong Kong's allure is fading. Hong Kong's attraction to global investors was always thought to be invulnerable, even with the crackdown by Beijing since 2020 on pro-democracy activists. But a five-year downturn in property values, amounting to around $270 billion, shows that Hong Kong is losing its once privileged status. The trend now is for Chinese and foreign capital to flee to more secure environments, like Singapore. Singapore's attractiveness rests on its Mandarin-speaking population, low taxes, and proximity to the China mainland. Figures show very large capital movements over the last 3 years from China to Singapore. Another possible Russian war crime. An extensive New York Times investigation into the abduction of 46 Ukrainian children into Russia has found that it was a plan approved by Putin himself, part of his project to erase Ukrainian identity. The forcible abduction of Ukrainian children is already one crime that has earned Putin an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court. The Russians, says one historian, quote, believe deep down that the children are Russian. You speed up their Russianness by kidnapping them, unquote. In this instance, the children were in a foster home when the war began. Russian officials seized them from their doctors and caretakers and removed them to Russia, where they were placed with Russian families. Banana Republic. Chiquita Brands, the banana company once known as United Fruit, has been implicated in the deaths of 8 people who were killed by a paramilitary group the company helped finance during Colombia's civil war. A jury in South Florida ordered the company to pay $38.3 million to 16 family members of the slain farmers and others. It's a rare case of a private company being held financially responsible for violence abroad. Chiquita executives admit making payments to the right-wing group called United Self-Defense Forces, which is listed by the State Department as a terrorist organization. During Colombia's civil war, that group acted as a protection agency for businesses against leftist guerrillas. But in killing and pressuring farmers, the group was enabling Chiquita to obtain land cheaply to convert to banana plantations. This episode brings back memories of when United Fruit operated in Guatemala in the 1950s. The company then was influential in CIA circles and in the U.S. decision in 1954 to overthrow a left-leaning government, preventing the Guatemalan government from nationalizing United Fruit's properties. A Palestinian professor in Israel is under investigation. Professor Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian, an internationally known Palestinian scholar who has taught at Hebrew University for 30 years, is under investigation in Israel for incitement to terrorism. She is among some 500 Palestinians so charged. The investigation is occurring because the professor joined academics worldwide in calling for a ceasefire in the war and calling Israel's assault on Gaza a genocide. She has also urged Israel to, quote, abolish Zionism. Her university tried to force her to resign, but right-wing politicians urged more punishment, leading to her detention. Her case is important since Israel, a liberal state in the past, is now punishing dissent by the Arab population while tolerating violent rhetoric and worse by Jewish Israelis. Finally, Netanyahu disbands his war cabinet. Now that 2 former generals have resigned from his war cabinet, Prime Minister Netanyahu has decided to disband it rather than replace the generals with 2 far-right members of his regular cabinet. But if this move sounds like an appeal to moderates, think again. Observers in Israel believe it simply concentrates more power in the prime minister's hands. With those 2 generals gone, says one commentator, Netanyahu has lost important voices. What he has now, he said, is more of an echo chamber. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, about his latest article. It's called Turnkey Act Seeks Congressional Approval for $1 billion in Annual Housing Projects. Oregon's Project Turnkey shows early successes could serve as a model for national emergency housing investments. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with me. So this new article of yours discusses a bill introduced by Oregon Representative Susan Bonamici to try to take Oregon's Project Turnkey national. Before we get into that, let's start with Project Turnkey itself. What is it and how did it start?
Project Turnkey was this $125 million statewide investment that turned vacant and underutilized buildings into emergency shelters. It started in 2020, and a big part of the point of this was to create emergency housing that was also socially distanced due to the COVID-19 pandemic. It also helped to address quickly the wildfires in late 2020 that displaced 4,000 people from their homes, and in which 40,000 people actually evacuated temporarily.
Well, Project Turnkey has been lauded as a very successful program. It's continued on in the years since it first started in 2020. What has that impact looked like by the numbers?
Yeah, they invested in two rounds of funding. One in 2020 was a $75 million investment, and then $50 million investment in 2022. The project funded 32 shelters in 27 cities across Oregon, and they're all owned and operated by the local community organizations that are in that specific area. They created almost 1,400 new shelter units, which is a 30% increase in the shelter supply, and actually represents 121,000 nights of refuge for homeless Oregonians. So yeah, that's kind of generally how successful it was, I guess.
And it's been analyzed by a few different groups, is that right? Oregon Community Foundation and also HRAC over at Portland State.
Yeah, the Oregon Community Foundation was handling all of the administrative stuff. They were administering the grants for these. And then they did their own report later that kind of tells what these successes are. Average cost per unit under $100,000. It's compared to like $226,000 in the statewide average per unit before the pandemic started. So they learned a lot in that second round of funding to be able to kind of make these a little bit more fiscally responsible. And then the PSU's HRAC Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative is in the process of evaluating the first round of funding, and that report is expected a bit later this summer, but that'll be a better idea from an independent source on how this whole thing went, what the successes were.
So Representative Bonamici has introduced the Turnkey Act to Congress, taking this thing that has been happening in Oregon and trying to take it national. What would that act do?
It would basically amend the Housing and Urban Development Home Investment Partnerships Act, which is a program that provides grants, essentially a lot of the same stuff, but for funding affordable rental production and maintenance and housing assistance, rental assistance for low-income households. This one, since the idea is to purchase old buildings that are underutilized, they basically amend that to add $1 billion in annual spending to purchase those buildings rather than new housing production.
I don't know if we've given an example. What are some of these underused buildings typically that get picked up by this kind of project?
I think most commonly in this one in Oregon, it was mostly motels. So they could buy a hotel, convert it relatively quickly, put in kitchens, things like that, and turn it into essentially single room occupancies, which is a very underproduced, that's kind of the least common and most desirable thing for people to get into, for a lot of people to get into. It can also be like old hospitals or other, you know, business buildings that can just easily be transitioned into a type of housing and supportive housing. We turn it into supportive housing with staff on site, be able to help people stabilize from all kinds of different conditions. So yeah, those are the kinds of buildings.
And how would it match up with housing and affordability efforts that are already happening at the federal level?
Well, there's probably a lot more to talk about in there than we can in a brief thing. But, you know, adding $1 billion annually for this specific kind of thing, for grants that are, you know, developed by the people that are in that community, could do something to address a lot of cities' needs. It's not probably the type of investment that would really see homelessness resolved, especially as you think about the U.S. Supreme Court thinking about punishing people for being homeless and how that is likely to exacerbate the homelessness crisis. This isn't necessarily the kind of thing that's just going to, you know, $1 billion a year is, you know, a small chunk, but it is something that can make a big difference for people in their own communities in the ways that they see fit for their own community.
What are some of the aspects of Project Turnkey that Representative Bonamici specifically thought was important to try to bring to a national level?
She held a roundtable with a bunch of people a couple weeks ago who have been involved in this, from, you know, county commissioners to people who are working at the nonprofits, to real estate experts who know how to, you know, go in and buy up these old buildings and actually do it with the right sort of land use, you know, statements and things that people need. And people really said that the flexibility of the program was very helpful. It actually goes into, you know, somebody mentioned if they like bought a hotel and then within a month or two, it needed to replace, do a whole sprinkler system, you know, fire system replacement. These kinds of funding can go to that, whereas a lot of these federal grant programs are really bottlenecked, you know, or only will go for specific things. So you could have a hotel and then the sprinkler goes out, but then you got to wait 3 years for another, for the grant to come through to fix that sprinkler system. So I think that flexibility part of it is really key. And then just how quick it was, it really demonstrates that when there is a political will, elected leaders know what to do when people lose their housing. People are in situations like a global pandemic and, you know, the wildfires in 2020. It really is this sort of spectacular thing that happens, and you can really see it. It's on TV everywhere all the time, and people go, oh, we got to fix this right away. But for everybody, every other person who's ever lost their housing, there's some other traumatic event that wasn't on the news. But when the political will is there, elected leaders know what to do to put people into houses. This is a shelter, just to be clear. Put people into shelter. This isn't a house.
Well, from this roundtable and from the folks that you talked to for this story, what are some of the lessons that Project Turnkey has learned about creating emergency housing and support services?
Yeah, kind of talking about that single room occupancy, you know, these are sort of, you know, there's a lot of dignity in being able to just close a door behind you and go to bed at night and feel safe. For a lot of people, there are a lot of other supports that people need. They need to get driver's licenses or, you know, any kind of documentation that can help them stabilize and be able to move on, transition out of there into housing. Here in the United States, people are discharged from hospitals regularly with no other place to go, and they're expected to recover wherever. That can be in a car or, you know, on the street in a tent. That is not good for actually recovering. So these kinds of things, you know, really, I think teach leaders, or can teach leaders, that dignified housing, the door to close behind you and to be able to come and go as you please, really gives people the agency that they need to be able to address the things, all of the different things that they might need in life to stabilize.
So returning back to the Turnkey Act, which is now before Congress, where is it at in the process of consideration?
It is currently in the House Committee on Financial Services and is just kind of, you know, waiting to be brought up. Whether or not this will be actually go into the full House this year, or if this is kind of just an idea that is being floated, you know, for some consideration in the future, is to be seen. But since introducing it and since Bonamici held this listening session a couple of weeks ago, two more representatives have signed on to it as co-sponsors. So it's making its way through the long, arduous process.
What do you hope that listeners and readers take away from this story?
I guess maybe it's more complicated, but somewhat simply, the leaders really do know what to do to provide at least emergency shelter for people. Just to be clear, this is not housing. These are, you know, houses are housing, but when it comes down to it, there are choices to be made here, and with the funding and with the political will, people can actually get people off of the streets. They just have to invest in it.
If our listeners are interested, where can folks find a copy for themselves?
The best place to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor. They're usually in your neighborhood, and they accept cash, Venmo, and tips. And you can also find us at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't get to cover?
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. I appreciate it. That was Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden speaking with me about his latest article. It's called Turnkey Act Seeks Congressional Approval for $1 billion in Annual Housing Projects. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billen.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBOO.